This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Millions of northern Europeans are wearing coats indoors as energy prices skyrocket. Coming next, author and longtime energy watcher Nate Hagens interviews writer and filmmaker Nora Bateson in Sweden. Is this a trial run for living with less? Alex then investigates the liquid natural gas, LNG tankers, to save Europe, to save civilization. And what about the role of China? The dessert for this radio meal is a few minutes with the late French philosopher Guy Debord. He saw the social lie that keeps us pinned to suicidal lifestyles. Buckle up, this is Radio EcoShock. Sanctions and Russian natural gas cuts blew up energy prices and the global market. Countries from Germany to Japan are sliding back on plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions. They are contracting for decades more gas shipped from America, Qatar, and Australia. So it's boom time for natural gas. There is nothing natural about it. This is methane, just methane. And then liquid methane, the very same gas, estimated to cause up to one-third of warming and weather disruption. Methane is around 80 times more powerful as a warming gas than carbon dioxide. Methane levels more than doubled, going from 790 parts per billion in pre-industrial times to almost 2,000 parts per billion today. It's getting there. Conferences and institutions are already trying to find a way to capture methane back out of the air to save us from rapid warming, and yet we drag out more and more methane from the ground, shipping it around the world to burn it in the atmosphere. We are producing a catastrophic climate shift by expanding fossil fuels at this critical time. It is a boom as the biggest companies and national producers rake in trillions in profits. Liquid natural gas tankers are being built as fast as they can be. Big oil and gas is pouring money into the Permian fracking fields of West Texas and New Mexico. Qatar and Iran are working to bring the world's largest natural gas basin online. Antonio Guterres, UN Secretary General, called investment in new oil and gas moral and economic madness. There is no shortage of investors without ethical constraints, while billions of dollars pour back into shareholders' pockets. The few at the top keep it all, while the poor decide between food or heat. There are no windfall profit taxes, no thought of diverting profits into sustainable energy for the long term. Wrecking the planet never paid better for the few. As the LNG tankers became saviors of civilization, gas supplies became the center of geopolitics. Qatar is now leaning towards China. That industrial giant is buying up world ports and shipping facilities. Europe was rebuffed as the prime customer. More about that later. A lot of Europeans cheer for the big dash for gas. Sure, everybody wants to go fossil-free in the future. Maybe 2050. But right now, you know, it's cold. It's cold here. The factories need to keep running. When the massive ship Hoyg Esperanza docked at Wilhelmshaven, Germany, Chancellor Olaf Scholz was there to meet it. During wartime conditions in Ukraine, getting gas for the European population is framed as a patriotic duty. The Esperanza is a Norwegian-owned ship. It is 964 feet or 294 meters long. It is 46 feet wide and 85 feet tall. This is not just a liquid natural gas tanker. It is a floating storage and regasification unit, or FSRU. This single-ship factory combination came loaded with enough methane to replace 11% of the gas formerly coming from Russia. The Esperanza is just one of five floating terminals expected to be operational in Germany by the end of 2023. Another, the Neptune, is already in place. The five terminals should provide about a third of Germany's gas needs. The Esperanza came loaded with 170,000 cubic meters, over 6 million cubic feet of gas. This is an astounding amount of energy in one place. Is it safe? Well, sort of, and we don't know. Various authorities have produced risk statements for these giant LNG tankers and storage terminals. The biggest risk would be catastrophic fire. A former MIT professor, the late J.A. Fay at MIT, published his review in 2003. The paper is titled Model of Spills and Fires from LNG and Oil Tankers. If I understood Fay's work and other assessments I've checked out, an LNG supertanker is less an outright explosion risk as a source of unstoppable liquid fire. People living around ports are nervous. We don't want an accident like the Halifax explosion of 1917. A ship loaded with arms blew up when it ran into another. It killed about 2,000 people and demolished buildings. Instead, the projections for an LNG fire are that it would spread out like a fiery lake, and how far depends on the size of the hole and the amount of fuel in the tank. According to the very few discussions about LNG safety, there isn't a big risk of a gas disaster from smaller warhead weapons as might be carried by a drone. The so-called tanker wars between Iraq and Iran during the 1980s, an LNG tanker was hit by an Exocet missile. The ship was not sunk and did not explode, although we don't know if the missile malfunctioned. That, thankfully, is the only real-world case I could find. But a larger missile, like a cruise or a Russian missile, could surely blow all four tanks of the Esperanza. This is not a scenario impossible to imagine with war at Europe's doorstep, where energy is the first target. And the Nord Stream pipeline leading to Germany was secretly blown up, remember that? Then there are accidents. Grounding of the ship could tear open the hull, or it could hit another ship. It is also possible that a major rupture could occur without an ignition point, meaning many megatons of methane, raw methane, would be added to the atmosphere from that one super source. The real leaks come built into the system. Fracking is a major source of methane, especially in the United States. Radio EcoShock has broadcast a couple of interviews with Cornell's Robert Howarth. He explained the whole train of unnatural gas from the fracked rock through leaky pipelines. Older cities like Philadelphia can lose up to a third of incoming gas just through leaks in pipes and equipment. Even storing methane means more emissions, as tanks are vented regularly into the air. There is no charge for tossing methane into the atmosphere, no price per ton, no fines for dumping it in most situations. The floating LNG terminals are just one link in that leaky train. I won't go into the technicalities of freezing methane and shipping it at minus 160 degrees C, minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit. You can imagine very large amounts of energy are required to do that for 6 metric tons of methane, to freeze it, keep it frozen over a sea voyage, which may transit very hot places, and then turn it back into gas. A report by the Natural Resources Defense Council says LNG is responsible for about twice as much greenhouse gas as ordinary natural gas. 14% of the climate footprint of LNG comes from gas leaks, flaring, or intentional venting during production and transport, end quote. The only study on the total emissions of an LNG tanker on the sea was funded by the gas industry. The paper is titled Total Methane and CO2 Emissions from Liquefied Natural Gas Carrier Ships, the First Primary Measurements. The study was led by Queen Mary University of London. They took a trip on the chartered gas carrier Gaslog Galveston from Corpus Christi, Texas, to Europe. They found, quote, CO2 emissions were lower than what other studies have assumed while venting, and fugitive emissions of methane were also extremely low, end quote. The study was funded by Enagas SA, the Spanish energy company and operator of European transmission systems. Enagas owns 4 methane regasification terminals in Spain. I could not find any independent studies of emissions specifically from LNG tankers or regasification ports. Liquid natural gas is also being touted as the so-called green energy to power ships of all kinds. But in 2022, the European group Transport and Environment showed infrared footage of raw, unburned methane coming out of ships in the port of Rotterdam. It is called methane slip, just another source of the super-warming greenhouse gas along the way. In the super-gas tankers, as the outside of the LNG containers warm, there will be boil-off, causing an expansion within the tanks. In newer tankers, that boiled-off methane is used to power the ship's engines and generators. The generators turn out to be the worst for methane slippage emissions. But if the main engine is off and the tanks sit heating, the excess pressure has to be vented into the atmosphere as methane. God knows how much methane is vented at sea, far from prying eyes. And what is the value of a large LNG ship? Well, just the ship's time is very costly. Prices tend to peak and then crash. It depends on demand and the amount of new tonnage entering the market. The average spot rate for LNG tankers in late 2021 was around $250,000 U.S. a day. By October 2022, that was $500,000 a day and expected to go much higher. The daily rates vary, but they are seldom cheap and certainly not during an LNG bidding war between countries who are dangerously close to economic or even social meltdown if the energy system cannot cope in winter. The actual gas in a mid-sized LNG tanker was worth more than $15 or $20 million U.S. in 2011. Lately, that went to $175 or $200 million per tanker. Add skyrocketing shipping costs to unheard-of high natural gas prices, and you can see why small energy traders without deep financing have been just pushed out of this game. And that gets us to concentration of ownership. The LNG global market has doubled since 2011, but Reuters reports the methane market is now controlled by just a few energy giants. Some are brand-name oil and gas companies, while others like Qatar and Norway are nationally owned. Reuters reported in September 2022, Shell and Total Energies are estimated to have a combined portfolio of 110 million metric tons of today's 400 million metric ton LNG market. Both Shell and Total Energies are partners in the North Field of Qatar, thought to be the world's largest pool of methane gas. With Qatar and BP, formerly British Petroleum, these four players control more than half the world's natural gas. Along with major producers Russia and Australia, there are about half a dozen entities which can heat the world. All of them announced hundreds of billions of dollars spent in expansions for more fossil fuels and long-term contracts to deliver gas for 20 years or more. That locks us into a methane path instead of renewables, at least into the 2040s. Scientists and even the conservative IPCC say that this change is going to bring us warming beyond 2 degrees by the end of this century, if not by 2050. In Germany, the Greens and Greenpeace warn the sudden move into LNG by the German government is the wrong direction. The government paid record-high prices, over $10 billion for the 5 floating terminals. It was all permitted and connections built in record time of just a few months. It can take years to get permits for a wind tower in Germany. Methane is displacing renewables.
Well, speaking of energy, in Germany, the build-out of renewables is moving slowly, despite a new push prompted by the war in Ukraine and the country's dependence on gas. Whether it's rising costs or Germany's often tenacious bureaucracy, almost everyone involved, from network operators to business owners and communities, believe things could move faster.
High energy prices could be a huge learning opportunity for Western consumers to learn to live with a lower impact on nature. In the second part of this program, Nate Hagens talks this over with Nora Bateson, along with ways we can prepare to cope with fragile energy supply. But the German authorities say the public and industry have not taken enough steps to ensure energy safety this winter. Even with higher prices, some keep their thermostats up. Some industries, high methane users like cement making or glass or brick production, they're having to limit production, adding to inflation.
The uneasy question in the back of my mind is, what if we have a really cold winter? Because if it's really cold, we'll have problems even when the reservoir is full.
That could see flames go out and factories close, despite Germany's state-of-the-art storage facilities.
The media tries to say Russian gas has been stopped, coming into Europe in the war. Not true. At theoilprice.com, analyst Charles Kennedy reveals European countries are still importing Russian LNG right now. The importers argue LNG is not covered by EU sanctions against Russia. And anyway, these imports help keep energy prices down for the people. It also adds to Russia's war budget, by the way. But Russia is still a minor player in LNG, at least, compared to the giants of Qatar and the United States. About 70% of U.S. LNG exports in recent months went to Europe.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
And now we hear Japan gets on the LNG bandwagon. Caught by geopolitical tensions and the war in Ukraine, many countries were counting on the miracle ships of LNG to fuel their economies. But the less developed places in Asia and Africa are now shut out of the game. They can't afford it. Almost unreported in the West, Japan has reversed its policy to move from fossil fuels to renewables. That was their policy. In December 2022, Bloomberg reports big Japanese companies like Mitsui are contracting for more LNG from the Gulf state of Oman. Bloomberg's Stephen Strapczynski writes, "This also marks a shift for Japanese LNG importers that had been moving away from long-term deals on the expectation that a transition to cleaner energy sources would reduce gas demand this decade." End quote. And then there is the elephant, China. Trying to solve smog that kills millions annually, Beijing wants more unnatural gas. Unnatural gas delivers more power with less pollution than coal, which is still widely used in the country. In November, the Chinese announced a deal with Qatar worth over $60 billion U.S. They are tying up more production from that world's largest pool, the North Field, shared by Qatar and Iran. Chinese companies have deals on both sides, with Qatar and Iran, to develop more gas than the atmosphere can possibly tolerate. High-level European delegations went to Qatar last summer trying to get gas for this perilous winter to replace the missing Russian methane. But the emir chose to pivot to Asia instead. That is an important geopolitical development which could affect us all in years to come. One energy trader suggests Europe may find enough gas this winter only because China's production was slowed by the COVID pandemic and an economic slowdown. If China's engine recovers, it could be even harder for European consumers and factories to get gas next winter. In the past, the United States has provided weapons and bases to protect American interests in the Middle East. But even a visit from President Biden last summer failed to get increased production from the Saudis to keep gas prices down. Instead, the Saudis went with the Russian plan. China has created a web of controls over maritime shipping and ports around the world. Nationally owned Chinese companies control the Panama Canal, one of the world's biggest shipping ports in Piraeus, Greece, and dozens of other port operations from Sri Lanka to Africa. It is like the Belt and Roads Initiative, but this maritime version could be called the String of Pearls. Simon Watkins is an international author and advisor for oil and gas investors. On November 28, 2022, Watkins published his perceptive warning about Chinese moves to control fossil fuel resources in the Middle East. Their LNG contract with Qatar starts in 2026 and lasts 27 years, right past 2050. Watkins noted a string of Chinese high-powered energy deals began just weeks before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Watkins says that shows, quote, a degree of foresight that seems more than coincidental. You know, a whole environmental and scientific movement arose around worry of methane escaping from the Siberian Arctic areas. But meanwhile, most of my listeners burn methane in our homes, or turn on electricity powered by gas, or work for companies who depend on methane. As the comic strip character Pogo once said, "We have met the enemy, and it is us." So when methane companies promote their patriotism, they also mean, and the current state agrees, "We will defend your way of life to our dying moments." Their well-funded voices whisper, You don't need to change, at least not now, maybe 10 years from now. Some magic will save us. Nuclear fusion, or is it aliens, or artificial intelligence, or God, will save us from this impossible way of life they want us to believe. This is a wicked problem for anyone who cares about the environment and the future of life. No person of feeling wants anyone to freeze in the dark. But as our next guest, Nate Higgins, points out, we need to prepare to live without fossil fuel emissions any greater than nature can safely absorb. This could be the learning trial.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Nate Higgins is the director of the Institute for the Study of Energy and Our Future, an organization focused on educating and preparing society for the coming cultural transition. 2 weeks ago, you heard Nate, along with Paul Ehrlich and Bill Reese, avoiding the ghastly future. In 2020, we spent an hour with Nate on his work, Reality 101. Nate has begun a podcast series called The Great Simplification, and recently video interviews he calls Frank. This is Frank number 20, Staying Warm Data. His guest is Nora Bateson, a brilliant writer, educator, and filmmaker who moved to Sweden. She reports back from a Europe where turning on appliances is a luxury some cannot afford.
Hello, I was going to do a Frankly this week on nuclear. That'll have to wait till next week. Some new news on nuclear fusion. I'm going to give a outlined debunking the opportunities and constraints of nuclear. Since that was kind of involved, I instead called my friend Nora Bateson, who is in Sweden, where electricity prices are 30 to 40 times higher than they've been in the recent past, and asked her what's going on. What is she doing in response? What are people in the country saying? What is the government saying? It's kind of a big deal and maybe a dress rehearsal for what's coming to some other places. Here's a short conversation with my friend Nora Bateson. Hello, Nora. Great to see you.
Hello, Nate. Great to see you, too.
Welcome to my Frankly episode. I do have Frank. Frank's on the ground below me taking a sleep because it is snowy and cold here. Is it snowy and cold there?
Snowy and cold, yes.
I just looked on the map, and Sweden is way further north than Wisconsin than I imagined. It's like as far north as the Yukon Territories in Canada. You're really up there.
It's the refrigerator. It's Scandinavia. It's winter. This is what it is.
And it's also dark, darker than in summer by far.
It gets dark now by 2:30 in the afternoon.
So the reason that I'm inviting you to have this conversation, first of all, I haven't talked to you in a while. Great to see you.
Always.
But I saw your Facebook post. I saw your Facebook post yesterday or the day before on how extreme the energy prices are now in Sweden and what people are doing, what you're doing in response. And I just think it's so topical. It's like a dress rehearsal for things that you and I have been working on and discussing for a long time. So maybe just tell me what's going on.
Well, the price of heat has skyrocketed. The price of electric has skyrocketed, and therefore the price of heat. Primarily, houses in Sweden are heated with electric heat. Most of the time that electric is produced by either nuclear or hydro plants. So we don't really have those big oil tanks in the back of the house or natural gas that makes heat here. That's not really part of the program. So when the electric price goes up so extremely, people are in trouble. And so to give you an example, not very long ago, in early November, late October, the price for electric per kilowatt hour was about 42 öre. Now, 42 öre is about 4 cents. And that's really cheap. Okay? It's probably too cheap. But right now, it's upwards of 800. So this is an extreme jump. Now, some people are locked into 3-4 year plans that they made last year. Lucky them. And they are okay for now. But a lot of people had to get a new plan this year, or they were on a flexible program. And so they are caught. And for those people who are on the fixed plan, there's been some promise on behalf of the government to do some reimbursement. But looking closely at that reimbursement, if you you might get a couple hundred dollars back, whereas the energy bills are upwards of, for a normal little house, upwards of $1,000 a month right now or more. So things are changing quickly, and you can imagine what this means for businesses. You can imagine what a grocery store is paying, or a hair salon, or a just, you know, anywhere you go. So, of course, systemically, it's drifting everywhere. This price increase is moving into all parts of life, where it can't actually be solved back with the electric price. And what's interesting to me is how we are adjusting, because this is a fast adjustment. Okay. No one was really prepared for this, you know, except for maybe the real preppers. And
well, you said even in October or November, it was 1/20th of what it is now, or yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So that's extreme. And so you learn quickly how to live your life differently. And we learn, you know, you don't run the dryer. Just don't run the dryer. If you want to dry your clothes, you hang them. But you better hang them in front of the fire, because the house is freezing. We're keeping our house at 14, 15 degrees centigrade, just enough to keep the pipes from freezing. And we're not alone. There's lots of families who are doing this. And you don't turn on the tea kettle. You don't use the electric oven. You don't use the hair dryer. You turn off the floor heat in the bathroom. You take really short showers.
So let me ask you this. I have tons of questions. You haven't actually gotten a bill yet, though, right? So when people are anticipating, because they know what the price is, the bill's going to come later this month or in January. So when you look at a hair dryer or an electric oven, and you're about to get the human brain services that we get from cheap energy, do you then in your mind translate that to dollars or the Swedish money?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I don't want to turn that on because next month I'm going to have to pay a lot for that. Is that what's going in your mind?
It's past that point. I mean, we have this app, okay? So this app shows me, I'll put it where, let's see, where we are right now. So this is where we are right this second. We're at 731 euro, and this shows the time of day and the ups and the downs. So we follow these ups and downs, and we try to run the washing machine accordingly, or turn the heat on accordingly.
So it's not grid-based management. It's your own individual management to the prices.
Right. So this is this week. All right. Yesterday, it actually went up to 918. But look at this. 3 years ago, it hardly ever even went up as far as 500.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I feel like my house is populated with all these machines that are just sitting there. And you don't turn them on. Like, you just don't do that.
So I don't know about Sweden, but in the United States, there was a recent essay that showed the average American household had 60 things that were plugged in all the time. Mm. And that was like a 10 or 12% drain of the total energy use. Mm-hmm. It's just being used by things that are plugged in, sitting there, not being used.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to Nate Hagen's interviewing Nora Bateson in Sweden on the Frank podcast.
This is all fascinating to me because, you know, my work is about, we really live in a biophysical economy that energy and materials power things, and we use money and technology to grease the skids and to have as our proximate story. But now, what a massive shift. So are you talking to your neighbors and people? What are people, how are people reacting in Sweden, in Stockholm and in the countryside?
Well, it's cold. It's really cold because also outside today, it's -5. So, you know, we bundle up in the household and we are, this is a culture that's much more individual based. So if this is a place that is kind of geared around self-reliance, which is a deterrent to the type of collaborative and cooperative possibilities. So by contrast, I have a friend I believe she's in Ireland, and their prices are also skyrocketing. But what they're doing is they have a group of friends and they're going to each house for dinner. So they're rotating so that it's, you know, 1/8 of the price because there's 8 people in the group. Do you see what I'm saying? So that type of collaboration is where it's at, but we are not there yet. However, I can only say that this culture of everybody having their own machines and being self-reliant is not really going to be an option. People cannot afford to live alone. They won't be able to. We're going to have to start sharing these costs.
Well, I just extrapolate that to, you know, driving across the state where I live, you see areas that have these huge 6,000 or 7,000 square foot houses. And if electricity was as high as it is in Sweden, could you imagine the bills that's going to be to heat those places? And I think, I mean, you're right. We're going to have more people living per structure if energy prices really increase in the future. So do people in Sweden think this is a short-term thing and next year it's going to be back to the good old days? Or is there some sense that this or something like it could last?
That is a really interesting question. And I think it varies. I think there's some people who have been watching other systemic processes and are thinking, well, this may be more than just a fix it. You're talking into causation here when you ask that question. And the causation is all too easy to place on, okay, well, this is because of the war and because the pipeline got burst and because Angela Merkel made a deal with Russia to get the natural gas and they don't have it. So now Sweden's selling power to the rest of the EU and then we have to buy it back. And it looks like it lives there. And therefore, if the war ended and the pipeline were fixed and the da-da-da-da-da, then maybe the prices would go down. But is it? Is that really where it lives? Or is this more of a continued consequence of big everything being a problem? Big energy, big ag, big education, big pharma, big tech. And the fact that the politicians and the people on the ground can't seem to stop it because the electric companies right now are making unmitigated profits. So it's not like there's a lack of electricity. So what is going on?
Isn't one of the nuclear plants shut down there for maintenance unexpectedly or something like that?
That is part of it also. But that's not all of it. And so yeah. This, you know, it starts a long time ago. So where does it end? So where does it start and where does it end? And these things place the situation in a linearity that's not quite so easy. So it could be that the electric bill goes down, but the food bill, the, you know, all the other things have been moving around it, supply chains, et cetera. So it's whenever you see this type of a whiplash in a very interdependent system, you're going to be seeing consequences that are in multiple contexts, not just the electric bill, but actually very seriously in the culture.
So I have to drop this pun in here. Maybe you should keep track of all this and call it keeping warm data.
Staying warm data.
Yeah, staying warm data.
Yeah.
So Is there a sense, and I don't understand the intricacies of the EU rules, but as part of the, you know, the European collection of nations, there are some energy laws that you have to export a certain amount to the greater European grid. Is there any nationalistic sense that Sweden is relatively energy independent because you have so much nuclear and hydro and biomass and other things that there's a, we don't want to have to be forced to export our energy? Are conversations like that bubbling up or not so much?
Absolutely, they're bubbling up. And they're bubbling up in exactly that description that you just made, as well as a general degradation of trust in the state, which to you and I, who didn't grow up in countries where there was trust in the state, is very serious. Because part of the way that the whole Scandinavian program has worked is with the social welfare and the idea that the government is actually benevolent. Now, this may seem ridiculous to you, being in the States, and it certainly does to most other places in the world, but this is the foundation upon which the state has its stability. So what we're seeing here is that's why I was saying it, very seriously, there's changes in the culture happening. So you're seeing a loss there of trust in the state to be able to respond and to take care of people. Okay, that's the deal. I pay big taxes, you take care of me. And the take care of me isn't happening.
What sort of messaging is coming from regional or national governments on how to manage? Are there public service announcements on turning down the thermostat or things like that, or what?
And TV shows, radio shows, it's the buzz everywhere on how to keep your heat down. And if you talk to any Swede today and you see them in a Zoom call, they're going to be wearing their puffer jacket in the house. And
which is not a disaster, by the way.
No.
I mean, I often do that. And when it's really cold here, I sleep in one of those thermal sleeping bags if the fire doesn't reach where I'm sleeping. I think the disaster here is we have a longage of expectations, not so much a shortage of energy. And now we're at the inflection point of that conversation. And we can live significantly differently, but ripping the Band-Aid off is going to hurt and be cold, metaphorically. But energy prices are not that expensive in the United States yet. But what you're experiencing, I expect, will come to all of us in coming decades. And it may be on the permanent side. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to get your, you know, boots on the ground perspective on this. Are you seeing any application to your work and working on culture change, and this is an opportunity, or what are your thoughts there?
I mean, I'm with you. This is not a disaster for me, right? Mm. And that's yeah. Important. There are a lot of people for whom it is a disaster. And I think that the changes that we are discovering are needed, and that there's no need to go back. You know, we actually should be watching how much energy we're consuming. And it was like we were on a runaway spending spree of just using the juice out of every plug in every room. And yeah. So this is a good wake-up call to the realities of that. And I'm with you. I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. And I also think it's going to take different shapes. And because of that, the politics of this are that you can respond to a crisis here or a crisis there, but it's not staying in the box. So this becomes a food crisis. This becomes a healthcare or a all sorts of different issues can come out of this. Most of all, the lack of the pixelating of the state is really the issue. But my work in Warm Data is really about nurturing a kind of flexibility to be able to respond to all sorts of stuff. So the sentence I usually use here is it's about nurturing the flexibility that we don't yet know we're going to need. So it's not about getting a perfect crystal ball, you know, forecast of what the future is so we can align the perfect preparations. It's about how to be in relationship with each other, with your body, with your land, with your neighbors, with your parents, with your, you know, with your children who may live a long way away, and that those relationships then produce a kind of possibility for response that is in stark contrast to the individualistic go out and buy yourself a kit for survival type of behavior.
I totally agree with that. So instead of preparing for an energy economic change, prepare yourself behaviorally so you're flexible to any of these changes, and not only yourself, but yourself in relationship to everyone in your life. I totally agree with that. Just out of curiosity, how are our families and schools handling the impact of their kids on this? I would suspect that kids would be less affected by this because they're tougher and more resilient, but maybe not.
I don't think we've seen it yet. You know, the thing is that when I first moved to Sweden, my husband said, don't worry, it gets cold here, but Swedes don't like to be cold. You won't be cold. No one keeps their house cold. It's not like England, he said, where you'll freeze to death in someone's house. And he was right. I mean, really, up until this year, I never set foot in a house that was cold here. So there has been a just generosity of usage of heating. And my guess is that the schools are still warm. I think there's some folks who are in for a bad surprise. And I think there are a lot of people who actually aren't registering yet that even if they have a long-term plan, that the companies are probably going to claim force majeure and raise the rates on them. And that if there's bankruptcy, again, force majeure. And so there's a lot of loopholes for no one to be responsible and for the bills and the consequences to land on the individuals.
But I can see once the December bills start showing up in people's mailboxes that there's going to be a huge social reaction to this unless the government helps out somehow with the bills.
And right now they've kicked the can, so the promise of support is there, but if you do the math, it's so minimal that it's actually insulting.
But when you're going around your house and looking at what you could turn off, and you're thinking, oh, the government might help me with this, but they might not, so I think I better turn it off just in case, that sort of thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, I think you're right. I think the December bills are going to be a harsh reality. And of course, it's the holidays. This is not an easy time coming up for folks here. And it's like you said, it's because of large expectations and a kind of comfort that is being removed. And, have you ever been at the airport when somebody who got an upgrade, when they didn't actually buy the first class ticket, they just got an upgrade, and then that upgrade gets taken away? Have you ever seen that person get angry? It's a special kind of angry.
Yeah, it's loss aversion, but that's a microcosm for our whole culture on a century timescale, is we've become accustomed to first class seating. And now we're going to go back to coach, and coach is going to be fine, but it's the drop that's going to cause us to go a little haywire. So, you know, I'm privileged, of course, with all these lights on and a globe and a Dachshund on my lap talking to you on a Zoom call. But I can see this as a positive dress rehearsal if things kind of go back to normal. Because people will have emotionally experienced this reality, not only in Sweden, across Europe, and then we're so tied to the United States that we learn from what's going on. So I'm hopeful this is an opportunity to really think about how we restructure things in coming decades.
And the only thing I can add to that, because I am in absolute agreement with you, is that what's great is the unexpected stuff. You know, like I had an old whistling teapot that that I was like, why am I keeping this? We always use the kettle. But I kept it because I had a sentimental attachment to it. And now we can put it on the wood stove and make tea without turning on the electric stove, without plugging in the tea kettle. And, you know, just the things that you figure out to do. So I live with my 93-year-old mother is living in our house. So everybody also has very different needs, okay? I'm cool to sleep in my room when it's 10 degrees. That's fine. I can bundle up but she can't do that. So we are definitely tapering everything in one side of the house so that we can put more into her room. And then, you know, we might take our breakfast or our tea or our computer and go hang out in her room. So there's a whole new relationship coming out of everybody going to Nana's room to hang out because it's warm in there, including the cats and dogs. So there's
so
things
it sounds
that
festive
come out of
in
it.
A way.
Well, it's the things you don't imagine. You can't. The complexity of how you're going to respond is so in the detail. And I think when we think about the possibilities of future and future with upheavals, it's important to always remember that there is a huge quotient of weird. And the weird details that come up in the possibilities you find together are absolutely unpredictable, unscriptable. And that's wonderful.
Which gets back to your focus on the importance of being flexible against many different futures. Thank you so much, Nora. Do you have any closing thoughts? I really appreciate you taking the time with 24 hours notice to talk to me.
I love doing this and anything with you, Nate. My only closing thought is just that it's really important that the story get told in the complexity that it exists in, because like I said, it's all too easy to create a very linear causality of this. But it starts, you know, it starts in the Thatcher years. It starts when the real social welfare was sold to private enterprise. And when that happened, then the maintenance bills didn't get paid. Right? And it began to degrade. And so this is part of the flow of immigration that happened when Syria got their grain cut off from Russia in 2009 or something like that, 10. And there's a lot of story in here that is way beyond those, you know, numbers on that graph. And it's just too easy to point to the bill or point to the politician in charge or point to Putin or point to Merkel or whatever you want to point to. It's a whole world that has been working toward this for quite a while. And I think the listeners on your program are aware of that. So that's just something to always reiterate.
Yeah. I don't know that you know this because we haven't spoken in a month or two, but a few weeks ago, I spoke to hundreds of members of the Swedish government, their entire energy agency. I gave a presentation, which 5 years ago wouldn't have happened, right? Because of what's going on. All of a sudden, everyone is interested in how the pieces fit together and the complexity of our energy material growth money sort of system.
Good.
So it went well. I hope we use this as an opportunity to maybe shift the path of our culture. Thank you so much. Stay warm and keep thinking and working on warm data stuff.
Thank you, Nate. Nice to be here.
You just heard the Frank Number 20 video podcast hosted by Nate Hagans from natehagans.com. Check out his site for some of the most get-real info about our situation. You can find links to Nate's videos and more in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Nora Bateson can be found at the International Bateson Institute. Check out batesoninstitute.org.
Radio EcoShock.
Yes, this is going to be another exciting mission, Chucko. We'll be going to the haunted space station for further instructions. Right, I need some brave boys and girls who aren't afraid to live outside the law of gravity. Families who like to sleep in tubes and push buttons. Adventurers like you.
In view of the gravity of the situation, believing that radio has a responsibility to serve in the public interest at all times,
are you worried about crazy events? Do you think you're alone out there, perhaps the only sane one left?
The specialization of images of the world is completed in the world of the autonomous image, where the liar has lied to himself. The spectacle in general, as the concrete inversion of life, is the autonomous movement of the non-living. Guy Debord.
We know now planet Earth cannot support 8 billion humans, all consuming resources and creating the pollution that kills off other life and possibly our own future. No dictator or hero can intervene to save us, because those who benefit hold the ultimate weapons, the power of production, and the voice of media, and we play along with all of that.
The spectacle grasped in its totality is both the result and the project of the existing mode of production. It is not a supplement to the real world, an additional decoration. It is the heart of the unrealism of the real society. In all its specific forms, as information or propaganda, as advertisement or direct entertainment consumption, the spectacle is the present model of socially dominant life. It is the omnipresent affirmation of the choice already made in production and its corollary consumption. Guy Debord.
The crux of change is identified by Marxist theorists like the French philosopher Guy Debord. Our personal functions have been channeled to gather products which we use to build our unnatural identity. We are consumers. Some of us work to feed a specialized part to the machine, and that may be steel or video or user data. And are we feeling down or worried? New clothes or a new car will cheer us right up. Guy Debord was born in 1931 and passed away in 1994. He wrote philosophic works, he made movies and founded activist groups, often based in his home of Paris. Today we glance quickly at Guy's inspirational work, The Society of the Spectacle, published in 1967. The Paris revolts of 1968 quickly followed, and Debord was among those who occupied the Sorbonne University. What is the spectacle? Here is an English translation from the film version of Society of the Spectacle.
In societies dominated by modern conditions of production, life is presented as an immense accumulation of spectacles. Everything that was directly lived has receded into a representation. The images detached from every aspect of life merge into a common stream in which the unity of that life can no longer be recovered. Fragmented views of reality regroup themselves into a new unity as a separate pseudo-world that can only be looked at. The specialization of images of the world evolves into a world of autonomized images where even the deceivers are deceived. The spectacle is a concrete inversion of life, an autonomous movement of the non-living. The spectacle presents itself simultaneously as society itself, as a part of society, and as a means of unification. As a part of society, it is the focal point of all vision and all consciousness. But due to the very fact that this sector is separate, it is in reality the domain of delusion and false consciousness. The unification it achieves is nothing but an official language of universal separation.
Debord was also a founder of an influential French art and culture criticism movement called the Situationists. Anyone contemplating activism should learn more about them. In the Wikipedia entry for Situationists International, we find, in Debord's terms, Situationists define the spectacle as an assemblage of social relations transmitted via the imagery of class power, and as a period of capitalist development wherein, quote, all that was once lived has moved into representation, end quote. When the Industrial Revolution took flight in the 1830s, it was easy to see people's lives were rapidly redefined, literally, to fit the needs of the machine. In the days before mass transportation, mill workers needed to live near the mill. They were moved, some forcibly, others by a desire for wages, from their homes in the countryside into row housing in a town which became a complex city. It was not just a physical move. The consciousness of the British lower class had to be trained to punctuality and detail in order to work with machines. Minds were reshaped to fit the needs of production. Later, Marxists developed that knowledge further. In a second stage, developing more in America in the 1930s, ideas from Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, and Frederick Winslow Taylor enabled mass production of merchandise. The public had to be educated as consumers, and that was the role of advertising. De Boer might argue consumers were needed to fulfill the capability of production. Drawing on De Boer, we might guess a key to reprogramming human desires and ideas about ourselves is the subject must never awake to a new state or revert to an old one. Either would break the chain of production and social power. A separate state of consciousness, complementary to the needs of production and tied to it, has been created. It would replace the former direct experience of a lived environment by our natural selves, and it replaces it with the spectacle. These are not just circuses or a blockbuster movie everybody talks about and daydreams about. It is not just the media or social media. There is no single image for the spectacle, because it is a pattern of social behaviors allowing manufactured consciousness to replace the personhood innate to our species and possibly all species. Consider a modern human encountering a bear. The bear is not thinking about events on the other side of the planet and has never seen Seinfeld. The bear may have developed patterns of thought from parents or siblings, but we presume the bear is present to the immediate situation, which also contains a human, a strong stimulant. The human may at first be looking at an image in a phone, but looks up to see the bear and decides to record the encounter with the bear on the phone to post for friends later. Already, this is an extended event, possibly reaching thousands of others, stimulating their mental images and social responses for a bear. The human may not actually see the particular bear who is present, possibly with old wounds or distinctive ears. The human may be drawing on previously ingested images of bears, old news stories of killer bears, nursery rhymes of friendly childhood bears, all manner of things. De Boer asks, how present are we, really? The false consciousness of consumerism, noted by many Marxist writers, has to be built on replicas of reality, and they are never specifically true. In fact, the spectacle depends on our ability to lie to ourselves. This recognition of social falsehood helps explain the domination of denial in our world today.
In a world which really is topsy-turvy, the true is a moment of the false. Guy Debord, Society of the Spectacle, 1967.
With more reading, we better understand how a majority of humans try to pretend a global pandemic, violent threats to democracy, and climate breakdown are not happening. You can find various versions of Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle online. I will put links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock this week, and thank you for caring about our world.
The spectacle is the preservation of unconsciousness within the practical change of the conditions of existence. It is its own product, and it has made its own rules. It is a pseudo-sacred entity. It shows what it is. Separate power developing in itself. In the growth of productivity by means of the incessant refinement of the division of labor. Into a personalization of gestures, which are then dominated by the independent movement of machines, and working for an ever-expanding market. All community and all critical sense are dissolved during this movement. in which the forces that could grow by separating are not yet reunited. Guy Debord.